either. I don't see Representative Gilliam. I don't have a note that he's going to
go.
It doesn't matter.
Just knock this one out real quick.
It is?
This one.
Okay. House Committee on Rules has come to order now. It is 3 o'clock, 3:10 actually, and April 18th. The first, let's see, just some information for you. We're going to, committee members, we're going to move House Bill 2257 to next Monday, April 25th, because we don't have a fiscal back yet, and we should have that by then. If you haven't had a chance to look at the Dash 4 amendments, that's where we're kind of leaning toward right now, toward that, for your information. And we're going to open up a public hearing on HJR 46.
Mr. Chairman, HJR 46, upon approval by the voters at the May 2012 primary election, amends the Oregon Constitution to require that redistricting for legislative districts and congressional districts be done by a 3-member panel of retired court justices to be known as the panel of special masters selected by lot from a list of 12 selected, 3 each by the Speaker, the House Minority Leader, the Senate President, and a Senate Minority Leader from a list of 24 retired judges willing to be special masters. It requires at least one of the 3 special masters must be from each political party. It requires the final redistricting plan unanimously adopted by the panel to be submitted for a vote of the people at the next following general election. If the plan fails at the election, it requires the appointment of a new panel of special masters to generate a new redistricting plan to be approved in the same manner.
Okay. Thank you. The carriers of the bill aren't here. Apparently, we've had a little bit of confusion as to the connection there, Representative Krieger and Lindsay. But we do have 2 people who have signed up for testimony, and it's Bruce Miller and Janice Thompson, if you'd come forward. Bruce, if you'd start.
Thank you, Co-Chair Olson, Co-Chair Hunt, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm Senior Staff Counsel in the Office for the State Court Administrator. The Oregon Judicial Department is not taking a position on the policy of this measure, but there are a few technical aspects to it that we thought we would like to point out to you for your consideration as you move this along. The first thing that I wanted to discuss, and probably the most important, is to consider that on occasion it may be difficult to get a pool of 24 judges who are willing and qualified. The number of retired judges that we have tends to vary, and there are a number of qualifications in there, and they also need to want to do it. So you may want to consider having a safety valve in case 24 can't be reached. Another interesting item in the measure is that the judges are to be chosen by lot, but you need to have equal representation between the two majority parties in the state, and it's unclear for us how you can choose by lot and take that into consideration. So it would be worthwhile if the proponents of the measure and the body could give us some direction on how you would expect that process to work. Many of the judges are not registered with a political party, and so you may also want to consider a safety valve for the instance where you may not be able to have equal representation, or perhaps any representation of the major parties. The measure doesn't describe what will happen if the panel fails to produce a final plan, or if they don't meet the September 1 deadline, another place where you could consider a safety valve. There is what appeared to me to be a redundancy in subsection 4D and in 5B regarding approval of the plan by the people. So it might be worth seeing if in fact those are actually redundant and whether they need some more drafting. Another area of confusion for us is in the event that the plan is disapproved by the people, it's not clear as drafted whether the legislature appoints a new panel from the existing pool that the Supreme Court has given the legislature, or if you want the Supreme Court to prepare a new pool from which you would choose the special masters. The measure doesn't state where the panel will reside for administrative purposes. That's something that will need to be worked out at some point, whether it resides in the legislature or Secretary of State or the Judicial Department, because you do need that structure for hiring facilities and generally to keep this thing running. It's not clear to me whether the measure is meant to include all federal judges or only federal judges who sat in Oregon. So that's another drafting thing that could be looked at. And finally, just how this would work from our end, much of the information that goes into whether the judges are qualified is not available to us. We don't gather that information on our judges. Probably what we would have to do if this were to go forward is put together a questionnaire that we would submit to all the retired judges and try to gather that information so we can determine who actually is qualified and who should be part of the pool. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Janice Thompson, Common Cause, Oregon. We're neutral on this bill. Though we support the concept of an independent registering commission, this is definitely one of those, the devil is in the detail topics, and many of the details are problematic. I think the reason an independent commission is very worthy of consideration is illustrated by a story that actually came from a recent redistricting hearing, field hearing, when a legislator from that area gave some testimony. And the follow-up response from a member of the redistricting committee was basically, you want community ABC. And whether or not that was said inadvertently or in jest, I think it really illustrates a major concern about the current process of having legislators do it, which is a major element of what's going on is that legislators and their respective political parties are vying with each other to select their voters. That said, there's two important things to keep in mind about a commission approach. One is that regardless of who draws the lines, it's inherently a political process, and that's not going to go away, even if you have a commission. The other is that independent commissions in other states are not all the same, and not all of them operate under criteria that are as clear as in current Oregon law or provide the public input opportunities that have typically been found in the Oregon process. So that's, you know, one of our baselines then in evaluating an independent redistricting commission is that it has to be as good or better than current law, not just a change in who draws the lines. So I want to highlight, though, two particular concerns about HJR 46 that do seem to be linked to the fact that the bill is not a bipartisan bill. And just as the police captain in the movie Casablanca said, I'm shocked to find gambling is going on in here. I'm just shocked that there may be a political motivation behind this bill and it's hearing today in the midst of the redistricting process. So the two factors that are problematic about HJR 46 in that regard is that the redistricting criteria in current law are widely regarded in other states and organizationally we support them. So there is a concern then about some of the changes proposed in HJR 46 as being more about politics than good policy. One thing, you know, I've attended several of the hearings and listening to them as they get put online, and it does really seem clear that this is just not a one-size-fit-all process, and the introducing, as it occurs in HJR 46, this whole idea of ranking criteria, I think represents an inappropriate change from current law. A particular concern is that HJR 46 seems to either eliminate, or at the very least, because it's a constitutional amendment, put low down in the ranking, concerns about communities of interest and not diluting minority voting strength that are currently provisions in the statute. So that's a troubling aspect. Now, this does not mean that we think that past use of the criteria and current law has necessarily always achieved an appropriate balance. As I mentioned, this is an inherently political process, and the redistricting that occurred in 2001, even handedly looking at what the 2001 legislature did and what was done by the Secretary of State, I think could both be characterized as having partisan elements. Again, shocked that this, you know, could be the case. Another concern about HJR 46 is relates actually to some work that I've been doing with the League of Women Voters and really calling on the redistricting committees to hold hearings this spring on draft maps. That did not occur during the 2001 legislative redistricting process. What happened then was that there were, you know, a series of the informational field hearings, which are really great. Then there was one public hearing on both the House and Senate side to basically introduce the map. Those hearings were dominated by legislators and went directly into work session within 24 hours in both cases. So if you taking a look at HJR 46 as written, it would not prevent a repeat of that unfortunate 2001 situation. So obviously that's worth bringing up because it's a problem with HR 46, but I really want to mention it here because I would really urge you to suggest to your colleagues on the redistricting committee that after the round of hearings, the field hearings that are going to wrap up tomorrow, actually, I think, that there be public testimony and more than just one kind of pro forma, here it is kind of hearing on draft maps. And I think, you know, the technology helps make that possible. I'm not suggesting, you know, going back for a full round of hearings, but a significant set of subsequent input. And again, just highlighting an HJR 46 that's discussed, but it really wouldn't have prevented that situation. So those are the two main things in terms of, you know, how it interacts with the current redistricting process, which I think is quite frankly, a lot of what this bill is about. But other points, I mean, our retired judges, which are a group that's even less representative of Oregon's residents than the legislators, you know, the appropriate group to tap. I appreciated hearing all the other angles to that, picking that group. You know, the selection process still relies on members of the legislature, and that raises some questions. One, I think, positive feature of HJR 46 is explicitly including the opportunity for the legislature legislators to comment on the product of a redistricting commission. One plus side of having legislators do it is that they know their areas. And so that's a very, really important dynamic that I think can go hand in hand with an independent commissioning process. The catch is that the language on that point in HJR 46 does not make it clear that the independent commission can reject legislative suggestions. So that would need to be looked at. The date under which the redistricting plan prepared by the commission would go into effect, I just suggest checking with the Legislative Council for consistency with Measure 55. That was a legislative referral adopted by the voters in November of 2008. It may well be, if I'm reading it right, and there is indeed a problem with consistency with the Measure 55 language, it may be because there's also this requirement the redistricting plan be submitted for a popular vote, which, again, I'm just shocked that that might be an element that would introduce more rather than less politics into the process.
Okay, any questions?
Yes. Is anyone here to speak for this bill?
Oh, I think so. Denny Morgan is, I think there, we have one person, and eventually, I mean, like to maybe reschedule this and have the sponsors, you know, come in and visit with us too on this.
If I could just make a comment in response to Janice's point, the redistricting chairs are committed to having sufficient opportunity for public feedback on whatever draft plans are proposed, and that is absolutely going to happen. Don't know. We don't have a target date yet for releasing those, but it will happen.
Okay. Can I maybe ask one question too?
Go ahead. Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Janice, in terms of, I mean, you identified a couple specific things, one of which Representative Garrett just responded to in terms of, it sounds like more process tweaks in terms of the current redistricting process. As you look at the current redistricting process, criteria, the checks and balances on that process, having looked at other states and having looked at this option, I mean, do you see inherent structural flaws with the current process, the current redistricting processes we've got, or the concerns that the concerns I heard you raise were concerns about process, which I think our co-chairs are tweaking this session. But do you see structural flaws with the current redistricting process?
Co-chair Hunt and the rest of the committee, the a structural flaw in having legislators do it is that dynamic of legislators basically being able to pick their own voters. I mean, it's not quite that simple all the time, but that's, you know, when you boil down to it, that's what is you know, it's the tussle that's going on. So that's the part of it that just seems inappropriate. And as I mentioned, you know, having an independent commission process, the devil is totally in the details, and it by no means would remove that that political process. But because I think a lot of what I'm seeing in the hearings right now with people coming in and, you know, having testimony that, you know, you kind of listen carefully, you know, you'll see these two patterns of hearings, and one seems to be kind of suggesting that ABC for a district that probably would help one party, and some other folks testifying on, oh, the district should be tweaked this way. That would still occur if those hearings were occurring before an independent commission, but it would be a really different set of ears and decision makers taking in that information and then being able to just balance it with all the other variables. So I think there is a structural problem with having legislators do it. I just think it's really important to recognize that, you know, an independent commission, unless you really do it right, isn't necessarily like a huge panacea. The other element structurally is that the timelines are very, very tight. And so I think that's the other element in Oregon is about raising questions about the legislature taking on this process is you have the legislature has lots and lots of things going on during a legislative session, and adding this into the mix with this June 30th deadline is challenging. The technology, I think, is helping, you know, with that, but I think another potential advantage of not having the legislature do it is that you could turn it over to a group that operates on a little bit longer time frame and isn't also trying to do a lot of other business of the state.
Can I ask one follow-up question?
Go ahead.
You had referenced, Janice, the and I had not noticed this when I read the bill previously. Did I understand you correctly to say that there is no reference in this to keeping community of interest as a criteria, or it's just a lower priority?
Co-Chair Hunt and committee, that I think this is something you should talk over with the Legislative Council. it seems, because what this does is, I mean, this is a constitutional amendment. So for sure, any language in here takes precedent over statutory criteria.
Right.
So when it seems really clear that the constitutional language is on point with a specific item in statute, that, you know, that the constitutional language would hold, would carry the day. So I think it could be, so one interpretation is if it's not in the Constitution, then it's still in the statute, that, you know, it's no longer relevant. At the very least, I think it could be read as taking lower precedent. I mean, I think it's just confusing right now about what happens.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Can I speak to that?
Yeah.
As I read it, there's really no doubt that the current law would be changed dramatically, because current law places these various factors on kind of an equal footing. This amendment gives clear priority to county boundaries and city boundaries, and those are in descending order of importance if you look at page 6 of the resolution. And I can tell you, we've heard plenty of testimony around the state that county boundaries are super important. We've heard plenty of testimony that in some parts of the state they are not that important in terms of how people organize their lives. So, I mean, this is one of about 100 things I think need further consideration in this measure before we would seriously entertain it.
Okay. Representative Foley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for both of you, if you wish, although maybe not. Notwithstanding the difficulty of getting 24 retired judges who have never held a partisan office before, as this bill spells out, to be a special master, does it cause you any concern that we would have an independent commission made up of special masters who come from one very specific walk of life, nothing against judges, but, you know, I think most of them start out as lawyers. And so you have a very specific walk of life being an independent commission, and recognizing that it is a partisan process, and I don't think you'll ever take partisanship out of it. The fact that you don't know where a partisan leaning happens to be in a particular judge or not seems a little disturbing to me, I suppose, because I know judges also vote, and they vote one way or another. Does that give you any concern that we have this very narrow walk of life and don't necessarily know their leanings in partisanship?
I can say anything.
Mr. Chair, could I respond to that?
Well,
I would like to point out that under our current system, we have a very specific walk of life who does it, who have even a less reputation than judges. I'm talking about legislators.
I might disagree with you on that. We come from very wide, different walks of life.
But what we have in common is elected partisan office. And I think that this measure, Representative Holvey, speaks to maybe somebody who's a little less partisan. And that's why the judges.
Not that we want a dialogue at all.
No,
but we certainly we have equal members on both sides of that aisle on the committee.
Chris, you don't have to respond to that question.
Thank you for indulging us, Mr. Chair.
Co-Chair Olson, Co-Chair Hunt, members of the committee, Representative Holvey, I do want to touch on one aspect of that, and that is I can see your point on walks of life, but we have judges from all walks of life who grew up in all different parts of the state. So I feel I need to come to their defense, at least to that extent.
Okay, that's good. Representative Freeman?
Thank you, Co-Chair Hunt. So you've talked a little bit about the current law and the current way things are supposed to be done. Do either one of you believe that our current districts are made up following the statute as written?
Representative Freeman, co-chairs, The simple answer is the court said they were okay. They were challenged. They were found okay, which I think speaks to the discretion. I think the, as Representative Garrett mentioned, it's a topic that it's really hard to come up with a one-size-fits-all. And so whereas the language in HR 46 might take things to one inappropriate extreme in terms of trying to proscribe certain things, ways that I think also are a partisan advantage, the current criteria, I'm not saying aren't, you know, appropriate to look at for, you know, for improvement. And I think that but that's why I pointed to this is an inherently political process, and the 2001 redistricting that operated under the current law occurred in a legislative process controlled by a Republican legislature that was so interested in getting its plan adopted in 2001 that it proposed moving it as a resolution that would not require a gubernatorial signature. That level of interest in having that plan adopted under, you know, the criteria in current law, I think indicates, you know, there was a partisan
edge to it.
Okay, I
get what you're saying. Let me tell you what.
The flip side of that is.
Let me tell you what I'm getting to for you.
There was also that was dynamic once it went to the Secretary of State. So.
Okay. So, House District 2. We're going to talk about a House District. When I leave my home in House District 2, I travel south on I-5 and drive right by the community of Winston, which is not in House District 2. It's represented by Wayne Krieger, who goes all the way to the California border. Okay? I drive by that community. I go south on I-5. I cross the border into Josephine County. I'm still in my district. Then I leave my district and go into another legislator's district, yet another legislator's district, back into the first legislator, cross another county line, and then go back up to a little community of Weimer, which is in my House district. Which part of the current statute would tell you that that's an appropriate district?
Co-chairs, Representative Freeman, I think what's in current law that influences that kind of thing is the fact that this is a balancing test, and there's a range of criteria that are being balanced. And, you know, how that gets balanced and how it gets swung, I think, is dependent primarily in who's in control of the process. And that has been, you know, people and groups on both sides of the political
Mr. Chair,
spectrum.
I'll stop commenting on every point,
yes.
but it needs to be said that although the statute lays out several different factors to consider on a relatively equal basis, the primary consideration is equality of population, and that comes from the Constitution. And that has led to that. That is the primary reason why some districts may end up being configured in a way that doesn't look like it makes a lot of sense.
I knew that was the answer. I was trying to see if maybe they would mention
okay.
Okay. All right. Let's move on then. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Denny Morgan, if you'd come up. Sure.
Thank you, co-chairs and the committee. I'm actually here at the invitation of Representative Garrett since I was at the redistricting committee meeting on Saturday, and this subject came up, and he alerted us to this fact. So I took the opportunity to accept his invitation to come up and speak on this. First of all, I want to say I'm not a lawyer.
If you'd identify yourself,
I'm Dennis Morgan. I'm president of Forest Products Research Laboratory. First of all, I'd like to say I'm not a lawyer. I like to think of myself as an honest person, to quote a phrase. I find, you know, and based upon that, the language in, while I support the idea of an independent commission, I don't necessarily support this measure. The concept of the use of language of special master in this resolution to me is confusing, because under the law, a special master is appointed by a judge, you know, to carry out special specific duties. And so to say that you have special masters to carry out duties that are currently, you know, assigned to the legislature is a little confusing to me. You know, to increase my confusion, I'm not sure who this commission works for as it's described in HJR 46. Is it legislative? Is it part of the judicial? Or is it part of the executive? You know, the current statutes and constitutional language says it starts with you folks here in the legislative branch, and if you fail, which past history says you have a high chance of doing that, then it divulges to the executive branch. And those are clearly defined. The makeup of this commission, you know, A, by special masters, and B, by partial choice of the Supreme Court and the leaders of the House and Senate, and I'm not sure, you know, who controls this commission or who this commission and its final report goes to the Secretary of State. I think that needs to be, you know, queried up, at least from a layman's point of view. Excuse me for a second. One of the interesting points in the selection of the original 24 judges in the current language does not allow the judge to change their party affiliation during their entire term in office, which seems to me rather restrictive, and it could further limit your field that you can pull from. You know, if a judge serves for 34 years, they may have a change of opinion on what party they want to be affiliated with, but if they, under this language, if they chose to change their party affiliation, they would be excluded. That seems to me to be too limiting. One of the things that this bill does not do that the current legislation does this bill fails to identify a court of jurisdiction as a primary court. It allows any court to rule on the outcome, where the current law puts it to the Supreme Court. Now, I recognize in federal cases you can go to the federal court, but for legislative redistricting, the current law puts it squarely in the Supreme Court for expediency. As noted earlier, Section 5 refers this to the citizens for the final output to be referred to the citizens for an up and down vote. The Constitution doesn't, in the state of Oregon, we've never done that. That's been a legislative issue. That's one of the reasons why, in my opinion, we have a legislature. And if you do, you know, if it does reach a decision, sending it out to a vote in either the mayor or primary election, if it fails, you're back starting all over again. And in theory, when you send it out to a vote, you start putting it up for the people with the most money to argue a case that, you know, you could literally go through a decade or more of not having a final vote with just whatever the special commission came up with, ran for one election, then it got changed again the next time around. That seems to me to be a detail that should be worked out, that once a decision made, you know, we should be able to work it out for a period of time. A couple other things in here. It sets a minimum number of hearings to be held by the special commission. I think that's a lot. It sets it at 3, with 1 being after the map is produced. The current redistricting is having several more around the state. I think the input from the state is a very important issue. So I also personally believe that setting the number of hearings in a constitutional statute is getting into the weeds when the Constitution's in you know, it should be on principle, and I think that the legislature could create a statute to direct the number of hearings, which would be appropriate. I do want to address a couple issues, though, that that came up listening to testimony last Saturday and also again this morning, particularly the idea of a commission not knowing their political leanings or where their partisanship may or may not be. I guess my view is I think the legislature should be the first crack at redistricting. You folks know your districts, you have the input, going forward and understand the needs. The current system, though, there's an ace in the hole for the party who has the Secretary of State's office, and I think that is a significant issue. If you can't reach bipartisan agreement, it will go to a very partisan excuse me, not very partisan, but a partisan office has been out of the legislature. In some cases, I may view one holder of the office as very partisan versus somebody else's opinion. So that is my opinion. I think that the idea of an independent commission where you don't know what the ace in the hole is, you don't know what their leanings are, and that they will sit down and apply law, will force the legislature to reach a bipartisan agreement. Because if you don't know what's going to happen at the end, you better work real hard while you're making the work go forward. There was one other point that I thought of coming up. There is an issue in the HAR that sets a de minimis amount of variation, which is applicable to the state legislative positions, but it's definitely not applicable to the congressional seats. And the language in the current legislation applies the de minimis amount of variation to both houses. That would cause me some concern as to whether or not it would survive a challenge. And I'm, again, not a lawyer, and I don't know if you could parse or several, have several or split up the different language that if the federal government said, no, you got to have exact amounts for congressional districts and how that would apply back to the state legislative office. Although it might be interesting to push it forward and have a federal judge come in and say, no, you can't do that. They all got to be equal. Then every one of your offices, every one of your districts would have to be of equal population. Thank you.
Okay, any questions?
Okay, Chair Hunt. And not so much a question. I just wanted to follow up since you made a reference and you identified it as not necessarily a fact, but as your opinion in terms of the Secretary of State. I do think at least our current Secretary of State, who this would go to if the legislature doesn't do it, I hope the legislature does it, but I think this Secretary of State has demonstrated a great deal of nonpartisanship. I can think of decisions she's made that probably every one of us on this committee agree with and disagree with different issues, and that's probably about as it should be in a Secretary of State. She is a partisan only because that office is required. The only way you can get to that office is to run for it as opposed to some other offices is to run for it as a partisan of one party or the other. But I have a very high degree of confidence that were it to go to her, which I hope it doesn't, but were it to go to her in her office, that she would exercise great discretion and fairness in complying with the criteria in the current law, which I believe are better than the criteria in HGR 46.
May I respond?
Sure.
I don't disagree that the current Secretary of State is gone out of her way to be nonpartisan in a number of issues. I guess when we talk about constitutional amendments and when we talk about redistricting and things that affect the legislature, we aren't necessarily talking about the current occupant. What we're talking about is rules that apply for a long, long time. In 2001, if I have my dates right, the resident or the Secretary of State at that point in time had not been elected, had been appointed, and had been appointed by a governor who vetoed the bill. And that's the circumstance that can happen in a number of cases that go forward. So I think the fact that the current Secretary of State has great credentials as nonpartisan does not necessarily prevent future Secretary of States and future folks from being in that case, and it can be on either part, one way or the other, on the party. So my concern is not necessarily what you're currently doing now, because this resolution would not affect what you're doing now. As I read this resolution, this would have effect of people in the future. And so you're looking more at the 2021 point in time, which we don't know who the Secretary of State or the, at least let me, I don't think we know who the Secretary of State is. If we do, we have a problem. And we don't know who the members of the legislature will be at that point in time.
Okay. So, you know, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Work or public hearing on HGR 46, and I am going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3610.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3610 bans the retail use of cigarette rolling power machinery.
And Representative Berger. Good to see you.
Nice to see you, Mr. Chair. May I bring your first test buyer up with me, Mr. Newell? For the record, Vicki Berger, State Representative, District 20, and friends, I have become a cigarette manufacturer. Made them myself this weekend. They nice? This, however, is an empty box that they gave me free because I bought the cigarettes that they were going to charge $1.25 for that empty box. It seemed excessive to me, but they gave it to me because they were very nice folks. my cigarettes, there are one carton's worth 200 in here, less two, which I gave to my cigarette smoking friends for their considered opinion on the quality of my cigarettes. They both said they were a little strong, tasted, they weren't going to rush out and buy them, but they seemed to be in what I would summarize as a pretty good nicotine delivery system. In other words, they did the job that cigarettes are designed to do. And I can tell you they were cheap. I made 200 cigarettes, which is comparable to one carton. If I walked into, and I did go into Walgreens and say, you know, what's your range on cartons of cigarettes? I used to smoke, by the way, but I haven't for years, and so I don't even know. And they basically said roughly $35 a carton to $75 a carton at Walgreens. Okay. This machine that I made my cigarettes for, here's my receipt, I paid $29.95, but I got a $5 discount. They said that the regular price was going to be $34.95 when at some point in the future. But mine were only $29.95. Now, $22.25 of it was tobacco. $2.75 was the casings here and this box that they came in, but that's, and $9.95 was for use of the machine that made the cigarettes. So that's the breakdown of my $29.95 carton of cigarettes. So let me talk to you. Oh, this was the bag of tobacco that I bought that I put in the machine that made the cigarettes. Let me talk to you a minute about taxes, because this is what this is really about for me, because, you know, I sit on the Revenue Committee. The total taxes, state and federal, in a regular carton of cigarettes in Oregon is $21.87. This carton, $6.63. State taxes only, regular carton of cigarettes, $11.80 for a carton of cigarettes. This, $4.83. So while these are cheap cigarettes, they aren't taxed. That's part of the reason. This is taxed at a different rate than cigarette tobacco, at a much lower rate, I might add. What I'm suggesting in this bill is that this machine not be allowed in Oregon. And I have two tax reasons for it. In order to bring tax fairness to this product, in other words, in order to make this comparable in taxation to a regular carton of cigarettes, the only way you could possibly do it, since this is a make-your-own product, by the way, and they were very clear in their labeling, you're the consumer, you make it. Now, the young man helped me a lot, but I made these cigarettes. I feel confident in that. But the only way to bring tax fairness to this would be to have some sort of a point of sale where the consumer has to pay this tax. Unfortunately, we don't have point of sale in Oregon. We're not a state that can say to the consumer, oh, we're going to tax these. That's just about impossible. And to put it up, to set it up for this particular product would be very difficult. But and it's my understanding that there's exactly one of these machines in the state of Oregon, which is hardly a earth-shattering problem. But many machines of this type would definitely be a problem. We are a participant in the Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement. We are obligated to level the playing field between cigarette companies who pay into the settlement and those that are called non-participating, who are not part of that settlement agreement. If we allow non-participants to sell in Oregon at a cheaper and substantial rate, we get sued. And it has happened. So I would suggest to you that there's a simple solution, that we don't have to worry into the future of these things, which are basically perfectly good cigarettes that are not taxed the way cigarettes are taxed in Oregon normally. The easiest solution is just simply not allow this machine in Oregon. As I said, there's only one now. When there's 50, we have a problem. When there's 100, we have a bigger problem. We are part of the Master Settlement Agreement. I would suggest that this bill is timely and appropriate right now to stop me from becoming a cigarette manufacturer. And I appreciate your indulgence. Mr. Newell next to me walked into my office to talk about cigarettes, and I promised him an A in his Willamette political communication class if he came and sat next to me and said his piece on this subject. So I commend you, Mr. Newell from Willamette University, who literally got arm twisted. I don't think I gave him a choice about coming here, and that's why I asked him to come and sit with me. Thank you.
Would you prefer us to open up for questions to you directly right now, or
are
you
going
to stay
here,
there? And
whatever. I'm at your indulgence.
Okay. Representative Freeman?
Thank you, Co-Chair Olson. And thank you, Representative Berger, for bringing this bill. How long did it take you to make 200 cigarettes?
Well, the young man said, or the advertising basically said, 8 to 10 minutes. That's reasonable if you just tell at the time that the machine was working, but there were issues. I only bought this much tobacco, but they had to add a whole bunch more that they didn't charge me because it was 50 short, and I had to wait. And I mean, altogether, I spent probably a half an hour at this process. But it, you know what? If I got really good at it, I could probably do it in 10 minutes. But, I mean, it was my first time.
Thank you. I was just kind of curious. I've never smoked, and I've never bought cigarettes, so I didn't know how long it would take. It seems like that would be a daunting process versus just buying the box that's ready to go.
10 minutes. I could do it in 8-10 minutes if I got good at it.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you. So, Representative, banning an activity because we can't figure out how to tax it correctly strikes me as very strange. So can you walk me through the tax issue again? Because I noticed this is sponsored by many members of our Revenue Committee. I take it this really is about revenue, but I didn't quite follow your argument.
This is taxed at a different rate than cigarettes. This is basically pipe tobacco or loose tobacco or whatever you want to call it, tobacco, and it has a very cheap rate of taxation. If I could figure out a way to tax this when it's made into cigarettes in Oregon, I would have proposed it. But I can't because we have no method. And we've run across this problem, for instance, in 911 cell phone tax issues in the Revenue Committee, too. There are some things that when you aren't a sales tax state that it's very hard to
Now I
to
see
tax.
The root of the problem.
Yeah. And that is, you know, a significant issue. It is possible as an individual to buy a machine to roll cigarettes at home, and I have no objection to it. Buy this tobacco, take it home, roll your cigarettes in the comfort of your home. This is a commercial operation that we don't need in Oregon. We have plenty of cigarettes, and I would commend that it's probably now's the time to say no to this particular type of cigarette manufacturing, because that's what it is. It is a type of cigarette manufacturing. A unique one.
Go ahead, Representative Freeman.
Just because we're kind of on the topic of the one machine and stopping it before it becomes a bigger problem, my guess is there's some investment in the one machine. Is there any thought to...
About $35,000, and I would recommend to the owner that he could probably get rid of it on eBay.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Representative Winger.
Representative Berger.
I do impress.
You are crushing somebody's smokes somewhere. I am wondering, is not possible for a person to use this machine and then resell the cigarettes, correct? It has to be for their personal use?
that is the understanding. There's nothing that says they couldn't walk out the door and peddle them on the doorstep. I gave the two extra that I made. We're too short here, but I gave them as gifts to my smoking friends to just test them to see, you know, how do they smoke? How do they taste? Because I don't smoke. And they said, a little strong, wouldn't rush out to buy them, but they tasted like cigarettes. I mean, they certainly looked the part.
I think you did a fine job.
Representative Garrison,
you held up the bag and said this isn't taxed at the same rate.
As this, there's a different rate for loose tobacco than tobacco that is in a cigarette pack. It's considerably less.
And that's a function of state law?
Yes, of state tax laws.
And that's different from the point of sale issue?
Yes.
So another approach would be to equalize the rates?
Oh, I'm sure that would be great. It's a 36 vote, I think, but we could do it.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Barhart.
I don't think, Representative, that you said this, but I think the clear implication is that at least one of the uses of this function machine is to evade the cigarette tax. Is that your view, or am I making that up?
No, I'm simply saying that that these are very inexpensive cigarettes. And the reason that they are, I mean, I know profit centers when I see one. I ran a small business. This is a golden profit center. You pay, I had a fax machine that I just made tons of money on because people would pay a dollar for a telephone call. It was incredible to me. These things are taxed at a far lower rate and sell for just under the cost of the cheapest carton of cigarettes. But the tax on these is so much less. I mean, less than half. So this is a very useful product that I think will grow in this economy. I haven't even spoken. I'm going to let others speak to the evils of tobacco. But what I'm saying is that if we let this go, we are soon going to have a problem around how these things are taxed, because they are so much cheaper just simply because you don't collect the tax on them. There's so little tax on this product. There's a lot, I don't know how much tobacco goes into a regular carton, but I was surprised at how little tobacco went into this carton of cigarettes. And when I did the numbers on how little tax is being paid, less than half, it's pretty clear that they can afford easily to give me a $5 discount on my carton of cigarettes for a long time, in fact, and undercut the market, which gets us into that master settlement agreement issue in a hurry, because we have to put in escrow non-participating providers or manufacturers product under the master settlement agreement. And I don't know how other states who are in the not all states are in the master settlement agreement, but we certainly are.
Mr. Chair, could I ask Representative Berger to explain that piece of it again, because that went by pretty quickly.
But under the master settlement, and don't ask me all the difficulties, there are participating providers, and they are paying us a significant amount of money. So under the master settlement, there was a great fear that, oh, that's great, then other manufacturers of this, of tobacco products come in, and they can undercut the market.
Sure. Right.
And so basically states are under an obligation to make sure that by their taxation and by their laws that that doesn't happen. And if the tobacco companies think that you're not doing enough in this arena to make sure this is fair, they sue you. And we have been sued on that before.
Okay.
So it's a matter of the fairness of those who have paid into the master settlement not being undercut by those companies that did not pay into the master settlement. It's a tax fairness issue.
Representative Holvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This will be quick. So I'm assuming that you've probably thought about this, but all the same. So rather than prohibiting the machine, is there a way to make sure the machine charges the appropriate tax per cigarette to give us that?
That's my point exactly. If we were a sales tax state, that would be pretty straightforward. But it's the consumer that makes the cigarettes.
Do you view a sales tax as a friendly amendment?
For those of you who have not been on the Revenue Committee, you need to understand, We have no mechanism for collecting this kind of tax. We don't have the kind of mechanism it takes, that a sales tax takes, to just simply say to the consumer, you're going to pay this we don't have any of the infrastructure around that. That is one of the difficulties we've been struggling with over the minutes on your cell phone. That's one of our difficulties. Other states tax that at point of sale. We can't do that because we don't have the infrastructure to tax at point of sale. And these are manufactured by the consumers. They aren't. I mean, I made these cigarettes, you guys. I did them
we
myself.
Believe you.
I'm a manufacturer of cigarettes.
Okay, two more questions, and we're going to move on then to
yeah.
Mr. Newell. Okay. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. This is really a comment rather than a question. The Master Settlement Agreement is a complex agreement. It definitely does exactly the things that Representative Berger is talking about, and it is designed in part to protect the tobacco companies that entered into the Master Settlement Agreement by making sure that we don't allow what amounts to anti-competitive activities in the state of Oregon because of differentiations in our tax rates and a variety of other things. So this escrow thing that she's talking about is real and is important. We actually put some local manufacturers out of business a couple of sessions ago by requiring them to pay into the escrow accounts as required by the Master Settlement Agreement in order to comply with that Master Settlement Agreement. One of the other results of that decision was that it protected our tax revenue and our revenue under the Master Settlement Agreement so that we actually could afford to pay off the bonds that were sold during the last recession in order to close out the budgets in, I forget, 02, 03, I don't remember what year. But it's a fairly complex revenue issue. My understanding of the bill, and I don't understand it completely, but my understanding of the bill is that the suggestion here is simply to not open a loophole by allowing these machines to be used in Oregon. That's all.
Tim. Thank you. Representative Freeman.
Thank you, and I'll be brief. So, a couple arguments. One is the whole master settlement tax argument, and I get that argument, and I understand the difficulties there. The other argument was about, well, there's only one of them now. Let's stop them before they get all over the state. Understanding that somewhere, somebody is trying to make a living, at least in part, having this machine, was there ever any consideration of saying, we're just going to have one, leaving that one alone and not let any more come through, like a grandfathering clause?
Representative Freeman, I would consider a grandfathering clause because I feel kind of a partial
I noticed sense you seem to be pretty excited
responsibility
about
around this particular machine. Okay, I would consider an amendment. But, you know, it's hard to make these kinds of distinctions in tax laws, and
doesn't say them. That doesn't help your master settlement agreement.
That doesn't. But
right.
One machine, as I say, is not going to end smoking as we know it. I get that, and I do feel a pretty proprietary sense about my own creation here.
One more.
Thank you. While you're considering that amendment, please consider the normal life of a machine of this sort. For when the grandfathering would go away.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Newell.
Well, thank you, Chair Olson and Chair Hunt and the rest of the committee. I'm here. My name is William Newell. I'm a student at Willamette University, and I'm here to testify on behalf of this bill. Interestingly, like we've been speaking about the tax issues surrounding this legislation, but there's a real human impact to this legislation. According to the CDC, or the Center for Disease Control, tobacco kills more people than HIV, illegal drug use, alcohol use, motor vehicle injuries, suicides, and murders combined. Now, this fact, this actually rounds out to about 433,000 deaths a year. From tobacco. So what we live with is that tobacco has a real effect on our lives, either through having a family member who is injured or who gets sick or dies because of they get lung cancer or they get emphysema or something like that, or we are indirectly affected in that our coworkers are not at work and so they're sick and so they have to go get medical care, and that's a drain on our state's resources, as well as these people aren't working, so they aren't feeding their families and they aren't taking care of themselves, and so it only perpetuates the problem. And so it's actually really sad, and I have my own personal story that my grandmother actually got lung cancer and nearly died, and like my mother and my aunt and my whole family had to basically stop and go take care of her. And so I was without my mom for a while. I mean, and being an only child, that was pretty sad, but like I nearly lost my grandmother, and both of them are lifelong smokers, and actually sadly my grandma continues to smoke today, and my mother actually quit after years and years and years of trying to quit simply because she saw what my grandmother went through. And so this speaks to the persistence of cigarette smoking and how insidious it can be for people who are affected by it, but also that it speaks to how we should solve these issues, and that is prevention and assistance for those who are already addicted to cigarettes. And so we have these programs that work for prevention, and Oregon has a variety of ways in which they do that. Higher taxes are scientifically proven to reduce children's rates of smoking, as well as older people's rates of smoking, as well as education programs and assistance programs for people who are addicted to nicotine. Those exist. That's the TPEP program, or the Tobacco Prevention Education Program. And so the taxes go to fund this program, as well as are an incentive in themselves to stop smoking. And so while we have all of these rules and regulations that help people prevent smoking or stop smoking, what is really happening is this loophole that is being opened up by the pipe tobacco labeling, and then thus creating these cigarettes that are roughly half the cost. It provides a massive financial incentive for someone who is already smoking, or for a child to go out and to smoke. I know for myself that kids like my age don't have fine tastes. We don't go out and we don't smoke Cubans. We go out and buy whatever is there. We would rather drink Pabst rather than like Heineken, basically, is what it sums up as. And so it's easier for kids to go out and buy products like these, especially when they're cheap. And I've actually met fellow students who go to these machines and actually that you can buy just packages of unpacked cigarettes that then you can roll into cigarettes on your own, and they have machines to do that too. So it doesn't just affect older citizens or children, it affects kids in college and people everywhere. And so basically what the rules and regulations we already have are an investment in our future. We're making an attempt to improve the quality of the life of Oregonians. And we do this in several ways, by reducing the burden of having bad health, as well as the burden on the state and other people to provide care for them, which makes everyone's lives more productive and happy. And so with this loophole, it only seeks to undermine all of the work that has gone into like creating these programs and passing these taxes and all the debate and sweat and hard work that has gone into getting people off tobacco goes away. We put a new future burden on those that will come after us, because they will be burdened by more healthcare costs that either have to come through their own paying for them or state taxes that go to provide this care. And so I feel that House Bill 3610 provides us the quickest and best opportunity to seal this loophole in order to prevent an undermining of an investment that we've made in our future, so that we can make the lives of Oregonians better now and tomorrow. Thank you.
Questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Oh, Representative.
I think he gets an A.
Pardon me?
I think he gets an A.
Oh, an A. That's A. Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill.
Okay. Mike Dewey, Dan Miner, and Brian Hughes. Or Haynes, excuse me. Brian Haynes.
My telephone.
Okay. You want to
you want to call him?
Yep, call him now.
If you want to just wait a moment, we're going to get Brian on the phone here.
Thank you.
I got to tell you, I'm struggling with determining whether I am in revenue committee right now. Human services. Okay, I'm seeing Katie King back there, so, but I get it, we're in rules, all right.
They'll all be here before it's over.
That's not judiciary, I know that. But then Representative Garrett's here, so.
Mr. Chair, the co-chairs of the Revenue Committee did ask for the bill.
They did ask for the bill.
For the record, the co-chair of the Revenue Committee did not, or the Rules Committee did not ask for the bill.
What do you think? Dial it any time, I guess. Brian, this is Jim Stambridge. I'm the administrator of the House Rules Committee here in Oregon. You're on our speakerphone, and all the members can hear you, and we're ready to go.
Thank you.
Okay, Brian, we have this is Representative Andy Olson, one of the co-chairs on the Rules Committee. We have Mike Dewey and Dan Miner as well, and I'm actually going to ask Mike Dewey to start out.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair Olson and Co-Chair Hunt, members of the committee, Mike Dewey, representing RYO, Inc., Roll Your Own. And let me, I have Dan Miner with me, who is the owner of the Hollywood Liquor Store. And he has the machine that we've talked about. Brian Hayes.
Can we stop just for a second to make sure our witness can hear on the phone?
Brian, can you hear everything that's being said?
I can. Thank you very much.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Mr. Haynes is on the East Coast, and I didn't think we ought to burden him with coming out. He's our expert. He's a lawyer and has been involved in some litigation on this issue we'll talk about briefly. And the tax issues and other issues that you might want to have with us, but I thought he would be a good resource, and so he's on the phone. And I appreciate very much the committee staff working to get this done. I thank you. So when I first started looking at this issue, I did not know how many cigarettes were in a pack, and I was amazed how many legislators knew that, and how many packs were in a carton and all those kind of things, what the cost of a cigarette was, or a carton was, but I looked at this and I thought first about fairness. And there's a company, Zigzag, that makes the paper. And if you do away with the machine or machines that operate in this state, and I'm sure the makers of the machine, which is an efficient machine, by the way, appreciate the way you look at it, that this is something that might work. But what we're going to be doing is taking someone that rolls their own cigarettes today. It's 3 to 4% of the population. These are committed smokers, good or bad. They're older, and if this works, they go from rolling their own cigarettes to using this machine because this is a pretty good product. Now, as the good representative, and we were going to try and get a customer here today, and they looked around to see if that was going to work, but because of, quite frankly, the situation with our economy and the cost of gas and the like, we weren't able to do that. But we do have Representative Berger here, so I did appreciate that we were able to get a customer. Now, as she said, this takes between, about 12 to 15 minutes. When you're at the capacity, you're going to be making in a store between 20 and 25 cartons of cigarettes. And I don't smoke, so Representative Berger said that her friend said that this is a little lower quality. Part of the problem you have is when you do increase taxes, there is behavior that occurs. And you know that in your, Representative Barnhart, in your class on the revenue committee about the elasticity and what occurs. So as you raise taxes, and I agree, this we can have a tax discussion And we'd love to have that, and Mr. Miner will talk about that in a few minutes. But if this is about taxes, we ought to have that discussion in the Revenue Committee, and we're happy to have it, because if you want to raise the taxes, he's willing to look at that, and there are ways to get at it. We're happy to brief the Master Settlement Agreement in terms of that issue, because quite frankly, we think that's a red herring with regard to this particular issue. Also, I did want to say that I was able to take a look at, and some of you were able to see it, and I can get you the website that shows how this machine works, and it's like an ATM. And so it showed this machine, and Representative Berger knows now how it works. And then right after that, they showed the manufacturing of cigarettes by manufacturers. And it was pretty compelling because it was a cascading of cigarettes coming down. I mean, it looked like thousands in 3 seconds. And compared to in a day at a store, 20 to 25 packs. Now, also, the Bureau of Tobacco and Alcohol in 2010 tried to enforce a rule, and this is now in federal court, and the client that I represent and others were able to get injunctive relief that this product or this service, this machine, does not represent being a manufacturer. And so that's an ongoing debate. So whether or not, and we all play the legal cards from time to time, whether or not you pass this bill, you might not be able to do it because they are, in fact, not manufacturers. And we don't think they are based upon 8 to 9 different theories. And so what I'd like to do, Mr. Miner is the expert, and if you have any technical questions, Mr. Haynes could go through this, but at the end of the day, I just didn't think it was fair to put people out of, this is legal in Oregon. Whether or not you like smoking, it's legal. And whether or not we know where this is going to go, we have no idea. There's one in Oregon right now. There aren't going to be that many because, in part, this is kind of like you want to make sure when you buy and invest $35,000 in a machine, and he'll talk about the other investments you have, you want to make sure that the smoke shop down the block doesn't have a machine. And so there will be a limit when it's all said and done because of how the market works. I'd like to know and predict what's going to happen, but I have no clue. But I just thought there was an issue of fairness here, and that's in part why I'm here. Mr. Miner, if you will, might go first, and then we can have any questions. And I really thank you for your time.
Dan?
Co-chairs Hunt and Olson and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Dan Miner. I own the Hollywood Liquor Store located in Northeast Portland. I've operated that since I was appointed agent in March of 2008. Today's kind of a bittersweet day for me. 1 year ago today, I was returning from Iraq as an Oregon Guardsman, and now I'm here trying to defend my business. House Bill 3610 would prohibit retailers like myself from allowing the public to operate a power machine to roll their cigarettes. I purchased the machine in March of this year and allows my customers to roll their cigarettes using an efficient process. I do own the only one today in Oregon. And it would materially harm my business financially if this machine became illegal. My investment in rolling cigarettes is substantial. Besides the machine itself, I've invested money in electrical changes to my building, inventory, advertising, and I've also hired one full-time and one part-time employee for the purpose of the machine. Also, other companies, including Natural Fresh Choice, sell roll-your-own machines, and there may be a number of these in Oregon currently. One of the reasons I made the investment was, as a liquor agent, I've seen my commission be reduced 4 times in the past 9 months by OLCC and due to some of the legislative rules. I was going to talk about how long it would take. I think we've kind of covered that. Currently, my machine has about 10% utilization if you look at the maximum capacity per day that my business is open. On average, I'd say my customers tend to be older folks. So far, I've met a couple that are in their 70s that have rode the bus down to my store, and they enjoy the cost savings. A lot of people do prefer to make their own cigarettes, and I've sold the tobacco at my store without offering or without the customer purchasing the use of the machine and rolling it right there. I don't see many young people using the machine, despite the previous testimony. I can't sell even a soda to someone under 21 in my store, so there's very little, and I'd say no opportunity, at least within my store, for this to encourage or attract underage or younger smokers. I currently sell Marlboros for approximately $56 a carton. And some of the generic, which actually I don't carry, I don't have that much demand. They're about $49 per carton. My list price hopefully will be $34.95. I'm offering an introductory discount, which you enjoyed, ma'am. I believe this bill would advantage one company over another and not affect whether or not Oregonians roll their own cigarettes. The legislature should not advantage a larger company over my single retail establishment in Oregon. Passage of the bill is not an answer to underage smoking, and passage would not curtail smoking because smokers will still be able to roll their own, just not at my business. And Representative Berger, I do thank you for your patronage. You did explain the tax difference in the two different types of tobacco. Currently, Oregon taxes or the loose tobacco that we could use at 65% of the wholesale cost. The per pack tax is $1.18, and it actually is fractions of cents after that. Even taking the difference in taxes, adding that to my retail price, presumably even adding some margin for me for that cost, I can still offer the customer a substantial savings because I'm eliminating the expenses that the master tobacco settlement companies have, largely marketing, their vertical distribution channels. I buy directly from the wholesaler and offer that to the customer.
Yes,
I would say that as the taxes have increased on cigarettes in just the 3 years that I've owned my store, generally what happens is that the retail price absorbs about half of that, and I absorb the rest of it in lost profit. I don't see any real absorption of the cost at the wholesaler distribution level based on my knowledge of their costs and the distribution. I urge you to oppose House Bill 3610, and I thank you for listening to my testimony.
And if I may very quickly, and I meant to say this with regard to this settlement, now these machines operate in other states, and we have not seen any action where the settlements in a number of states have participated. I haven't looked at this for a long time, but a number of states have participated, and Brian perhaps can answer it, but I haven't heard of any state that has been jeopardized by virtue of these machines coming in. In my mind, this is a zero-sum game. People are going to continue, and it's very few that are going to be using or that roll their machines and are going to use this machine because I think the behavior is I want to go out and buy my cigarettes as quick as possible, and I don't want to take 10 to 15 minutes to do it. That's why there's only one and very few in a lot of states. So with that, Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to answer any questions. We look forward to it.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Representative Garrett. We still have somebody on the phone here to testify to.
Yeah, you made the point about other states, but if I understood Representative Berger correctly, if you're a sales tax state, you can adjust your taxation to make sure that this isn't undercutting those providers who are participating. So is that possibly the explanation?
I can speak to Washington, for instance. They do have a per-pack cigarette tax, and in addition, at the retail, there would be a sales tax collected. But there isn't a separate sales tax for cigarettes collected. It's simply the current sales tax.
Okay.
Okay, Brian, you're on.
Okay, thanks. Co-Chair Olson and Co-Chair Hunt and members of the committee, thank you for your time. I just wanted to address...
If you'd identify yourself first.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Brian Haynes. I'm an attorney with Trauman Sanders in Richmond, Virginia. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I wanted to address four points very quickly and answer any technical questions the committee might have. Number one, as alluded to earlier, Oregon would be the first state to outright ban these machines. These machines, at last count, are operating in 35 to 40 states, although in some states there are discussions about regulating the machines in different ways. Oregon would be the first state to ban the machines. Second, in my opinion, the machines are tax neutral, and that is because consumers have rolled their own cigarettes for many years in their home, for decades even. Consumers who use these machines are, by and large, not traditional cigarette purchasers. They're folks who, if the machines didn't exist, would otherwise be producing their cigarettes at home with identical tax consequences. Whether the cigarettes are produced at home using traditional cigarette tobacco or tobacco that's labeled as pipe tobacco, the tax consequences are the same if folks do it at home versus in a retail store. Third, the use of the machines, I do not believe, jeopardizes the state's master settlement agreement payments. And this is true for two reasons. Number one, the machines, even in states where they are fairly prevalent, and those would be states with 100 or more machines, represent a very, very, very small percentage of the total cigarette consumption in any state. Even in the most prevalent states, the machines would represent less than 1% of cigarette consumption in the state. That small number, small amount of cigarette consumption cannot jeopardize the state's master settlement agreements, settlement agreement payments. As Representative Berger alluded to, the master settlement agreement is a very complicated document, but for the state to lose its settlement payments, the signatory manufacturers would have to show first that they lost market share as a result of the non-participants, and two, that the state didn't adequately enforce its existing statute. Number one, this isn't a significant enough number of sales for the large manufacturers to lose any significant sales. And number two, any escrow payments that are required to be made under the escrow statute are already being made. In the case of pipe tobacco, they generally aren't, but again, there's no difference if consumers produce their cigarettes at home versus a retail environment. With regard to the issue of the machines proliferating in the state, again, even if we had the number in Oregon that there are in other states, it would represent only a very, very small percentage of the total cigarettes sold in the state, and by and large would encompass folks that are producing cigarettes on their own at home. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay, members, any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
Can I ask Mr. Miner a couple of questions?
Absolutely.
Mr. Miner, maybe this isn't a question, maybe this is a comment, because I was in your establishment, and your cigarette machine, the minute I walked in, I said, cigarette machine, and the guy went, there. And I went over to the corner. And the truth of it is that I'm not mechanically adept, and you could call this a jobs program because you had a very nice young man who took me through this process and all but picked up my finger and said, punch this button now and open this and pour this now. Had I been better, I would have gotten to it. If I'd been a regular customer, I probably could have figured it out pretty easily. But I have to.
I would simply call that customer training.
And he was a very nice young man, and he gave me this for free, which I owe you. I was going to buy it, and I'd already paid. And he said, "Oh,
yes,
that's
his tuition to pay."
That's okay. That was very nice customer service. But I have to tell you that the reason it took me a half an hour was because when I walked in, there were two quite young women, I'm not saying under 18 or under 21, but in their 20s, who were in front of me, and they were making not a carton, but a pack of cigarettes as sort of a trial offer. They were very young, they loved them, and they loved the price, which speaks exactly to what the young man was, that these are not just attractive to old people who would, you know, go and roll their own if they wouldn't. And in fact, getting in and out of your store was difficult enough. I'm glad I wasn't with an older driver, at least one older than my husband, who drove me and had to drive around the block the whole time I was in there because you couldn't get in. So I would submit that walk-in trade and young trade would be very much a part of the profile of people who would use this. And, in fact, I can testify that the people in front of me were buying it by the pack at pretty great cost, and they were quite young.
Anybody else?
We would, if I could, Mr. Chair, we will take a friendly amendment, maybe to limit the number to 1,000 in the United in Oregon or something like that. So something to think about.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. Brian, hey, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. I have Katrina Hedberg and Stephanie Tennessweet.
Let me just ask our telephone witness, do you want to stay on the line or do you want us to hang up?
I can hang up. I'll just listen online. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
One of our many online fans.
Yes.
Proceed.
All right. Co-chairs Olson and Hunt and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Katrina Hedberg. I'm the state epidemiologist and office administrator for the Office of Disease Prevention and Epidemiology with the Oregon Public Health Division. And I would like to thank Representative Berger for introducing this bill. As I think Mr. Newell already testified, I'm here to provide information about the health effects of tobacco use. And without belaboring it, we have 7,000 people who die in Oregon of tobacco-related causes each year. And it costs the state of Oregon over $1 billion in medical care costs to treat people with tobacco-related illness. Tobacco has something that's called price elasticity. That really means if you increase the price of tobacco, fewer people will smoke, or the people who smoke will smoke less. People who are most sensitive to price increases in tobacco, or in this case price decrease, are frequently the young, people who, again, that was already testified, but young adults who may not have yet been, have developed a habit, but in fact are starting to use tobacco. So this bill, again, would prohibit the operation of these self-service machines, which has been testified already, really are a way to decrease the cost of cigarettes, which we're very concerned would then, if you will, promote or at least have an effect that more young people would start to smoke, and that would have adverse effects on Oregon's economy. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. You have my written testimony, so that provides more details. But.
Thank you. Stephanie?
Chair Olson, Co-Chair Hunt, members of the committee, my name is Stephanie Thomas-Sweet, and I'm the Director of Government Affairs with the National, or with the American Heart Association, excuse me. And I will just respond, actually, to a lot of the questions, as many of the comments that I have already been covered. Very clearly, tobacco remains the number one cause of death still in Oregon. It's very addictive, and it is a deadly product. There's no question about that. And as Dr. Hedberg attests, it's a major cause of heart disease, strokes, countless diseases, and it's particularly harmful for children. Some comments that I would like to address specifically that we've heard today about the increase in these machines. Cigarette smoking is very responsive to economics, and we know that cigarette smokers are more often in a lower socioeconomic status, and that it increases when the economy is down. In 2007 and 2008, right before the crash, national sales of cigarettes went down by 4.2%, but roll-your-own machines went up by 14.9%. One of the comments in a recent article from April 12th, this is from CSP News, is that I'm just going to read some comments from a recent article here. This is from Cincinnati, Ohio, and it says that when Roll Your Own Machine Rental LLC put out its first Roll Your Own Cigarette Machine in 2008, the company didn't know about the big change ahead that would alter its business landscape. It took us a year to produce the first 10 machines, Phil Accordino, president of the company, told Tobacco E! News. Now we are turning out in the neighborhood of 90 to 100 machines a month. Clearly, this is a very addictive product, and it is increasing very quickly. I think most of my other comments as far as the impacts to youth, particularly concerning, we're obviously very concerned about this growing and need to curb the habit immediately, so we urge your support. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Committee members, Representative Burke.
Ladies, would you comment on the fact that were we to ban this machine, as we heard testimony, it would be another Oregon first. We would be the first.
So, co-chairs and Representative Berger, actually, my understanding is that the state of Arkansas may have just voted on this, although it's not implemented.
Oh.
No, it's not being implemented until January 2012. So if you did pass this and implemented it sooner,
Arkansas,
we could still be a first.
And I can tell you that talking to my colleagues around the country, we are seeing this legislation pop up in several other states precisely because it's a growing concern and need. And, speaking on behalf of the Heart Association and working this session, the tobacco industry is going to do what they can to reach out to youth, going to do whatever they can to reach out to youth, find new markets. They're constantly looking for loopholes to create, to expand. If we could pass legislation to actually prevent that from happening, we would lead the country, and it's time that we stepped up and did that.
Representative Winger?
I just want to make clear what I heard. The company that sells cigarettes wants to sell more cigarettes?
It's shocking.
To quote on the previous testimonies earlier today, it's shocking.
Yes.
That one I didn't even pay for.
Anybody else? All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Very much.
Anybody else want to speak on House Bill 3610?
Eventually, this is going to be worth a gold bar.
Okay, seeing that we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3610, okay. And I guess we're going to open up a House Bill 3621, and I see that the sponsor of the bill is not here. And so,
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3621, this has to do with land use, and it's for persons who received a ballot measure 37 waiver. This is ballot measure 37 from 2005. It allows such a person to use the property as provided by the waiver if the person has expended more than $400,000 in that use.
Okay. We're going to close the...
Mr. Chair, this is now... I think we have two hearings today that Jeff Mapes may be able to feature in upcoming Oregonian stories as no one testifying in favor. Since he had so much fun with the bill we had last week, we had no one testify in favor. We've given him two new candidates today.
I think he's going to be tired of this.
He may be.
So you're thinking of an investigation?
I think you should do an investigation, Mr. Chair.
All right, very good. We're going to close House Bill 2621. 3621, excuse me, and we are
that actually has Representative Gilliam's name on it.